So I'd like to introduce now our second speaker, who's Sebastian Zeidler, who is a associate professor in the History of Art Department at Yale. Professor Zeidler has degrees from Oxford and Columbia University, where he took his PhD. And his book came out this year, The Lost Wanderer, Karl Einstein and the Ground of Modern Art. His title this morning is Matisse with Husserl, Rethinking the Picture in 1906.
Good day. And now for something completely different. It starts with the title page of my talk, which is meaning to suggest that I'm not distinguishing between picture and image for purpose of this talk. I am using only the term image simply because that's the accepted English translation of built in Husserl. And the second point of the title page is that this talk is a diptych composed of two gentlemen, and I'm going to talk about a painting by the gentleman on the right in light of the phenomenology of the gentleman on the left. So let's look at the painting, and here it is. We are looking at Henri Matisse's Young Sailor II, a portrait of Germain Montagès, a young fisherman whom he painted in 1906-07 in the port city of Collioure, south of Perpignan. It is the kind of work the critic Alexander Rom had in mind when he wrote about Matisse's portraits. They are free of all psychologism. They tell nothing of the inner life of the model. Between these portraits of Matisse and the deeply psychological portraits of Van Gogh and the young Picasso, there is a great gulf. Here, Matisse is deliberately superficial. Rom was one of Matisse's most discerning critics, and my suggestion will be that he got it exactly half right. The absence of psychological depth, interior space, and narrative setting in Young Sailor II prevents us from imagining what kind of person the sitter actually was. Montagès does not exist outside the superficiality of his portrait, or rather he does exist, but only insofar as he makes an appearance in it. It is this appearance alone on which Matisse's portrait stakes its meaning, and that meaning is a matter of looking over time. To understand how, I suggest we turn to a series of lectures which Edmund Husserl, founder of phenomenology, finished up at Göttingen a year before Matisse painted Montagès's portrait. Published as late as 1980, Husserl's lectures are among the most sophisticated modern theories of the image. In this talk, I will first walk us through their terminology and then consider Young Sailor II in its light. So abstraction first, concretion later. I have two reasons for drawing this connection. On an empirical level, I found Husserl's lectures to be a powerful sesame to certain aspects of Matisse's enigmatic work. And on the level of theory, Husserl seems to me a useful figure to bring up at this conference, since his reception on both sides of the Atlantic has been so uneven. On one hand, Husserl is now one of the mainstays of Bildwissenschaft. On the other, he remains a non-entity among English speakers. In my personal experience, if Husserl is familiar to North Americans at all, he is that as Derrida's straw man. And that is a pity. Husserl both was and wasn't a metaphysician of presence. He didn't need Derrida to deconstruct him. He was perfectly capable of doing that himself. Hence the subtlety of Husserl's theory of the image, and hence its relevance to Matisse. That is my argument in a nutshell. So, the terminology. In Husserl, every image consists of three aspects that are closely interwoven with each other: the Bildding, the Bildsujet, and the Bildobjekt. The Bildding is the image as material thing. It is paint that's been deposited on canvas in a frame. The sujet is what art historians call its subject matter. In Husserl, it may be either imaginary or real. Matisse's Montages and Botticelli's Venus are both sujets in his sense. Finally, there's the image object, which is where matters get intricate. To put this concisely, the image object is the appearance of the sujet in the medium-specific terms of the image as material thing. So, in Matisse's portrait, the painting on the wall is the material thing, the actual living Montages is the sujet, and the image object is his likeness, painted in oil on canvas in Matisse's particular style. Now, Husserl's central insight concerned what I call the ontological fragility of this image object. That fragility is defined by three facts. First, the appearance of an image object depends crucially on its viewers. Second, that viewing experience is necessarily instable. And third, the instability plays itself out over time in a paradoxical way. To begin with the instability, Husserl explained it by pointing out the minimal perceptual overlap or Deckung between the material substrates of the image on one hand and the sujet on the other. A painted nose may look like a real nose, but it isn't like one since it lacks its three-dimensionality, among other traits. The same is true for a portrait's likeness as a whole, because the individual brushstrokes that go into painting a face do not typically look like wrinkles or pores. And yet when we behold a portrait, a face is what we see. That points us to the central paradox of the image, which is that, as Husserl says, image consciousness is difference consciousness. It is only when the image as material thing is significantly different perceptually from the sujet that an image object will make an appearance in it. To use Husserl's own contrast case, a wax doll produces the illusion of a person that's based on a minimal difference and a massive overlap between wax and skin. But pigment on a surface produces an image object that's based on a massive difference and a minimal overlap between paint and likeness. Nor could it be otherwise. In order for an image to merge at all, there must be an antagonism, or Widerstreit, Husserl says, the antagonism between the physical painting on one hand and the image object on the other. Because that antagonism will trigger a difference consciousness which gives the viewer work to do, the work of seeing a person into paint. And that is my second point, which is that the emergence of an image object is radically dependent on us. Once we stop looking at a portrait, the physical painting won't cease to exist, but the likeness will. There are no image objects without viewers. And that's a point that Husserl implied, and which Sartre in The Imaginary underscored, and more recently it was also reiterated by Wolfram Pichler and Ralf Ubel in their image, in their Bild Theory book. What in Husserl's phenomenology is true for perceptual objects in generally is then dramatically true for the image object. Its esse is its percipi. Its being is entirely its being perceived. The stakes of that perception in Husserl are high indeed. The image object, he argued, and this is a quote, does not signify in the manner a symbol does. It doesn't point away from itself. It doesn't point outward, not even towards something that resembles it, end of quote. So contrary to iconography and semiotics, an image is not a sign in Husserl. Because an image is not referring us on, it is rather pulling us in. We have a strong, if vague, sense of a sujet's presence in a portrait, a presence which we know perfectly well is unreal, but which we cannot help seeing into it regardless. But that is another way of saying that the antagonism of the image poses a double visual threat, an explicit threat to the likeness we see and a subliminal threat to the sujet we imagine. If one goes, so potentially does the other. That threat, is my point number three, will play itself out in our perception of an image over time. Husserl's account of temporal perception relates his image theory to his better-known theory of time consciousness. To invoke his own example, when we're listening to a melody, the sound we're presently hearing is connected to the sound we heard just now and to the upcoming sound we're expecting to hear. The present moment of our musical experience is not punctual, but multiple. It is a now that's shaped by the retention of the past, as well as by the potential of the future. The same is true for our temporal experience of an image, in which the now of the present is always contaminated by a not now. Each will lay claim to the present moment at the expense of the other. Let me give a simple example. On the left, we have another portrait by Matisse from 1906 or 7, this one of his daughter Marguerite. At center is the same portrait on the wall of the Musée Picasso in Paris, and on the right, we see Picasso handling it at home. Between them, these three slides demonstrate how, in a typical viewing situation, the antagonism of the image unfolds as the unstable overlap between two perceptual fields. On one hand, there's the field of the painting inside the frame. On the other, there's the larger perceptual field of the painting, the larger perceptual field of the studio or gallery, the wall on which the painting is hanging, the room to which the wall belongs, the furniture, and the people in the room. The larger field is inhabited by real perceptual objects, the painting's field by an unreal image object. And so a competition is staged between seeing the painting as a material thing on the wall and seeing it as the home of an image object. The paradox here is that in order for the image object to continue to exist for us over time, the difference between the two fields must both be noticeable and must be maintained. It must be noticeable so that the painting's field is different enough from the larger field for the image object to appear at all, and it must be maintained so that the image object isn't overwhelmed by the larger field altogether. The antagonism between reality and unreality must be ongoing, but reality must not seem to be winning it. That is, of course, easier said than done. As we stand in a gallery and look at a portrait, we are always aware of its immersion in the larger perceptual field. At certain moments, the latter's reality will intrude into the former's unreality and conquer it. At that point, Husserl says, what we have is the appearance of a not now in the now. In the now, insofar as the image object appears within the reality of perception, and as it were lays claim to possessing an objective reality right in its midst. On the other hand, we have a not now, insofar as the antagonism turns the image object into a nullity, which, while it does indeed appear, is in fact nothing. So, as the image object devolves from likeness into nothing, the sujet is expelled from her own portrait, and we are reduced to looking at pigment that's been smeared onto canvas. That said, in Husserl, this moment of rupture is not the final state of affairs. There is no final state, since the antagonism of the image is necessarily interminable. It is not the case that one kind of present will ever permanently claim the now and demote the other to the status of not now. It is rather the case that our temporal experience of an image is continuously divided by the competition between the two nows, by a primordial oscillation that sustains reality and unreality both. So, let me test this terminology by looking at Young Sailor II. The textbooks describe the painting in terms of the fauvist liberation of color, but in Matisse, that so-called liberation went hand in hand with the fragilization of the image object. What Young Sailor II gains in radiant chroma, it loses in perceptual certainty. The art historian Wolfgang Schöne put the matter best when he once referred to what he called Matisse's twofold surface color. Schöne's point was that Matisse fundamentally reorganized the relation between color and light in painting. For centuries, color and light had been inseparable, and they had both belonged to the world of the image. But in Matisse, the two came apart when he evacuated light from the image and left only color behind on its surface. to understand that difference, let's consider a Michelangelo in nudo from the Sistine Chapel. The fresco comes with its own light built into itself. An implicit light source is located at a point far above to the right and just in front of the figure from where the light hits it at a steep angle. The result is chiaroscuro, that system of highlights and cast shadows which inflects the nudo's flesh tone colors and so models his powerful corporeality. It is because of this imbrication of color and light that the fresco's surface color is merely one-fold, so to speak, that the flesh tones seem to adhere to the surface of the body and not to the wall on which it has been painted. In Michelangelo, color is above all part of the image object, not of the image as a material thing. It is a different matter with Young Sailor too. Matisse has not just evacuated all shadows from it, but also the internal light source that generates shadows in the first place. For the painting is no longer implicitly illuminated from within, but rather only from without, from the gallery space in which it is hanging. As a result, in Young Sailor II, the distinction between Husserl's two perceptual fields breaks down. As the unreality of the image world opens onto the reality of our own world, the temporal antagonism between materiality and image object, not now and now, emerges everywhere across the canvas. Hence, the twofoldness of Matisse's color, the fact that it is often undecidable whether color is part of the surface of the image object, such as the sailor's skin or dress, or part of the surface on which it has been represented. It is because the adherence of color to body is loosened in this way that we will keep wondering what it is we are looking at. An orange-colored ear, or an ear-shaped field of orange color. A hand disappearing behind a cheek, or a palm-shaped section of pink. Another hand clasping a thigh, or a beige that's interlocking with a green. A related question concerns the brushwork. What is it supposed to be in service of? The modeling of the body? That is still the case in the first version of Matisse's painting called Young Sailor I. Here, he created the bulging volume of the raised forearm with short parallel strokes that even include some black shading, as if light were hitting the forearm from above and to the right. But in the forearm of Young Sailor II, Matisse not only purged the chiaroscuro, he also made the direction and length of his strokes conform to the oval silhouette of the sleeve. Right down to the micro level of the brushwork, the two surface colors of pullover and sleeve, of pullover and canvas, image object and pigment, do not overlap. Instead, they antagonize each other and so make our difference consciousness strain to breaking point. In Young Sailor II, that straining is drawn out over time. The painting's temporality of perception is replete with moments when the now of an unreal image object will devolve into the not now of reality. Take the strip of pink that's lodged in between the sailor's arm and chest. Beheld from a distance, it looks like a section of background peeking through, but from closer up it turns out to be a single brushstroke which Matisse painted on top of the pullover. Just where we expected to find a pocket of space, we are confronted with opaque materiality instead. That is what Husserl meant by the antagonistic nature of brushwork itself. The fact that a single stroke of pink can split itself up into the divided present of perception. The same is true in a different way for the sailor's lips, which Matisse painted in the complementary contrast of red and green. That makes Deleuze a programmatic example of the tension between building and build object. In terms of their shape, the lips are part of a mouth in a face, but their surface color is that of unmixed pigment from which all chiaroscuro has been drained. And again, the antagonism, which in this case is between shape and color, is extruded out into time. Over the course of our looking at the mouth, there will be moments when the complementary contrast of the lips is unsettled by the third ochre brush stroke underneath the red one. At that point, a visual vibration sets in, and we will be losing sight of both the contrast and the mouth. That vibration is the purest instance in the painting for the oscillation between not now and now. Here, we are neither looking at an image object nor at its material substrate, strictly speaking, but at the sheer volatility of the alternation between the two. To put all this another way and to sum up, Young Sailor 2 compels us to discover what Husserl called the different modes of an object's perceptual givenness. Mode in Husserl is a technical term that expresses the relation of a statement to reality. In a conditional sentence, the relation is problematic. Whether the statement is true is a matter of belief or circumstances. In Husserl, the same goes for the modes of an object's visual saliency, or what he called its evidence. In descending order, these modes include the certain, the probable, the possible, the doubtful, the improbable, and the impossible. That list reads like a lexicon of art critical terms for Young Sailor II. Nothing is certain in the painting, and all across its surface, the transition between modes is fluid. But if you wanted to be sticklers about it, we might say the sailor's left thigh and arm can stand for the probable, and his two hands for the possible and the improbable. Moreover, though, these modes will always be subject to what Husserl calls modification. So the sailor's mouth, as we saw, keeps oscillating between the doubtful and the improbable. And the pink brushstroke between arm and chest, which at first blush looked probably like a pocket of space, after a while turned out to be impossibly one. And so Alexander Rom did have a point. To look at the portrait of Montagès is to be prevented from imagining what its sujet might be like in real life. Instead, it is to be forced to wonder in what ways and how durably Montagès's image object will make an appearance for us. But that is another way of saying that Matisse's portraiture is depthless without being shallow, since there is a whole ethics of intersubjectivity built into it. The radiant color of his portraitees is the flip side of their temporal ephemerality. It is the viewer's task to sustain their being over time. Thank you.